Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome, curious minds. Today we are taking a depth dive into, well, a really essential text for understanding modern American consciousness, Joan Didion's 1979 masterpiece, The White Album.
Yeah, and this deep dive, it isn't just, you know, a nostalgia trip back to the late 60s or early 70s. It's more about exploring that precise moment when the American psyche seemed to fracture.
Right.
Didion wasn't just like listing events. She was chronicling the overwhelming, almost dizzying feeling of it all, the cultural, the psychological chaos when all those traditional stories society told itself just, well, they stopped working.
Stories about stability, progress.
Sanity. Even. They just failed.
And that's exactly why this book still hits so hard today, I think. Our mission here is to really get into Didion's pretty radical thesis that what happened back then wasn't just political turbulence. It was something deeper, a fundamental collapse of narrative coherence. She showed us what happens when you're forced to confront a world where the old certainties, they just offer zero guidance anymore.
And that framework is honestly incredibly useful for you listening right now.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. We live surrounded by this constant flood of information, rapid social change, and often that that pervasive feeling that Yeats wrote about, that the center is not holding.
Yeah, that feeling is very present.
Didion gives us this perfect lens, really, to examine our own fragmented reality. Mm-hmm. And she shows how that disorientation, paradoxically, can actually lead to, you know, deeper insight.
Okay, so before we jump right into the chaos she documented so brilliantly, let's maybe talk a little about the woman herself. Joan Didion, born in Sacramento, 1934. She was a fifth-generation Californian, which is pretty significant.
Oh, absolutely. That gave her this deep, sort of inherited knowledge of the myths of the American West. And she became the central figure in what they called new journalism. She honed her craft early on at Vogue, actually.
Right, new journalism. Maybe we should unpack that a bit for anyone who isn't familiar.
Sure. Essentially, it meant blurring the line between, let's say, objective reporting and more literary techniques. It involved inserting the writer's own perspective, their personal experience, directly into the reporting.
So the writer becomes part of the story.
Exactly. Didion herself becomes an actor, in a way, within the cultural story she's telling.
And I found it fascinating reading about how she used her own physical and psychological state, her anxiety, vertigo, migraines, almost like a professional tool. How did she manage to channel that hyper-aware seismograph feeling into the work?
Well, that's the genius of it, I think, that acute sensitivity. It wasn't a flaw for her, it was her radar. She sort of realized if the culture itself is having something like a nervous breakdown, then her personal, maybe neurological fragility made her uniquely equipped to register those tremors, tremors that other people were maybe ignoring or trying to smooth over with, you know, false optimism. And her style totally reflects this. It's spare, precise, very economical prose.
I was clinical.
Yeah, it gives her observations this almost clinical detachment, but at the same time, there's this profound emotional honesty. She could just stare directly at the most chaotic scenes with this, like, perfect clarity.
Okay, so turning to The White Album itself, it's definitely not a traditional book, is it? Not chronological.
Not at all. It's a curated collection. These are pieces written between 68 and 78, functioning as both memoir and really sharp cultural criticism. You should think of it more like a collage.
A collage, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, and it's very formlessness, it's fragmentation. That's actually part of the message, you know?
Yeah.
If the world feels incoherent, then the writing has to reflect that incoherence.
So the core idea is that those established narratives, the American dream, the nuclear family, the whole idea of steady progress, they basically became obsolete during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And she showed individuals suddenly feeling adrift, right? Forced to kind of construct meaning from whatever fragments they could find, because that stable meaning, it just wasn't inherited anymore.
Exactly. And the book's real power, I think, lies in capturing that raw feeling of living through massive historical change while it's happening. It completely rejects the historian's neat after-the-fact summary.
Right. It's messy.
It presents experience as messy, contradictory, often just incomprehensible, which is exactly how things feel when you're caught in a moment of crisis, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the scope is huge. I mean, she covers everything from the dark side of the counterculture, the Manson murders, to the kind of manufactured mythology of Hollywood.
The Black Panthers, the early women's movement.
And all set against that very distinct, almost artificial landscape of Southern California.
Okay, so let's start where the book does, with the title essay. It's really a masterpiece of fragmented consciousness, kind of the thematic anchor for the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it opens with that iconic foundational line.
We tell ourselves stories in order to live.
That's the one.
It's the foundation, right. And then the rest of the essay is this almost jarring demonstration of what happens when that basic ability, telling a coherent story, just completely breaks down. The whole essay is structured like a chaotic collage, these snapshots that really, they really arrest you.
Oh, definitely. Like, take that famous vignette of the Doors recording session. Diddy didn't see Jim Morrison as some, you know, countercultural icon or revolutionary god.
No, she saw him as...
detached. Bored, even.
Ooh.
A little confused. She sort of realized the whole scene was basically an exercise in manufactured rebellion, already being packaged and sold.
Yeah, revealing that commercialization almost before it had fully peaked.
Exactly. And then you have the contrast between that sort of Hollywood artifice, and the real-world horror, like the part where she remembers buying a dress for Linda Kasabian.
The Manson family member who testified.
Right. That incredibly mundane personal detail, just a trip to the store for a dress placed right next to the unimaginable horror of the murders. It's deeply jarring.
It forces you to feel that collision, doesn't it, between normal life and just absolute breakdown.
And that contrast is totally deliberate. It's the shock of reality crashing into the story we wish we could tell. And crucially, she explicitly links the public chaos to her own private struggle. She includes, verbatim, her psychiatric report from 1968.
Right, I remember reading that part.
It diagnosed her with severe anxiety, vertigo, effectively linking her personal inability to impose narrative order directly to the cultural chaos she was documenting. It's like she's saying, my breakdown is your breakdown.
Wow. So if the narratives were collapsing all around, where did she suggest people should look for the true structures of power? It wasn't in the Hollywood mythology, clearly.
Absolutely not, no.
Yeah.
To find the real source of power in California, she tells us, you have to follow the water. In essays like Holy Water, she dissects the State Water Project, this vast, mostly invisible system of aqueducts, pumping stations.
She treats those like the real modern cathedrals.
Precisely. It's a profound metaphor. She's suggesting this enormous hidden infrastructure, this artificial source of life in the desert. That's the true seat of California's power.
Yeah.
It symbolizes a civilization manufactured entirely by human will, you know, controlling nature rather than submitting to it.
And she contrasts that huge technical power with pure artifice, right? Like her analysis of the J. Paul Getty Museum.
Yeah, built in Malibu as this meticulously accurate recreation of an ancient Roman villa. I mean, you talk about a symbol. It's American attempts to manufacture culture, history, instantly, just through extreme wealth, believing money can somehow buy authenticity.
This skepticism she had about manufactured reality, it extends directly into some of her most controversial critiques, doesn't it? Especially her observations on organized political movements, like in the essay, The Women's Movement.
Right, and this section needs, you know, careful handling, impartially. Didion was fundamentally skeptical of any kind of unified ideology. So while she definitely acknowledged the movement's legitimate grievances, she critiqued what she saw as its tendency toward rigid, maybe overly simplistic narratives.
Okay.
She sort of felt that the insistence on a uniform group experience and maybe an emphasis on collective victimization failed to account for individual agency, complexity, the unique, often messy realities of different women's lives.
So it sounds like her resistance wasn't really to the goals necessarily, but more to the simplification that's often required to build a mass movement. She distrusted forcing complex individual experience into a neat political box.
Exactly. I think that's right. She applied that same cool, almost detached analysis to the Black Panthers, too.
Mm.
She went to their meetings, observed the Marxist-Leninist language, the revolutionary theater.
And felt it was disconnected.
She often felt it seems strangely abstract, kind of disconnected from the practical day-to-day reality of the people living just outside those meeting rooms. She was always looking for that gap, you know, between the rhetoric and the lived reality.
Okay, so to bring the personal and the apocalyptic back together before we move on, we probably have to mention In Bed, right, where she talks about her debilitating migraines.
Oh, absolutely. That intense physical pain becomes this perfect mirror for the psychological state of the whole culture. She's describing this constant underlying state of siege fragmentation, where even the body itself refuses to maintain order.
And it feels fitting that the book concludes in Malibu, where order is always shown as fragile. That constant looming risk of wildfires, mudslides, these indifferent natural forces that can just wipe away civilization in moments.
It serves as the final reminder, doesn't it, that any order we manage to impose is ultimately temporary, fragile.
So if we pull back now, try to distill it. What are the key enduring messages from this collection?
I'd say theme one has to be the collapse of narrative coherence. The old story shattered, forcing us all to become meaning makers from the fragments.
Mm-hmm. And the modern reflection there is just profound, isn't it? In our current age, with constant digital noise, social acceleration, we're still dealing with that fundamental challenge. Didion shows us the struggle to maintain stable values when the core cultural story keeps shifting under our feet. It's universal.
Okay, theme two, the commercialization of rebellion. She was incredibly prescient about how counterculture dissent gets almost instantly absorbed, neutralized by consumer culture.
Yeah, and what's fascinating there is how relevant that still is. Capitalism is brilliant at adapting to and profiting from its own critiques. That manufactured rebellion she saw with the Doors. It's exactly what you see today when brands or politicians or influencers quickly adopt and monetize anti-establishment aesthetics.
It just becomes a lifestyle brand.
Right, a marketable lifestyle, not a genuine threat to the status quo. And theme three, the persistent undercurrent of violence. She argues that the violence of that era wasn't some aberration. It actually revealed something essential, maybe brutal, about American character and history that had been sort of lurking beneath the sunny surface of post-war optimism.
Yeah, it forces you, the reader, to confront those difficult truths about underlying societal tensions. It suggests that sometimes, maybe, violence is necessary to strip away the comforting illusions we use to disguise those foundational problems.
Her prose style, too, it just created some of the most resonant, memorable lines in modern American literature.
Oh, absolutely. We have to start with the core idea, the necessity of meaning-making. We tell ourselves stories in order to live.
It's the intellectual thesis, really.
If we don't construct meaning, chaos reigns.
And then the phrase that just perfectly captured the cultural condition she was documenting, that deep sense of instability, the center was not holding.
Yep. I also love the quote about California, her home state, capturing that American paradox so well. California is a place in which a boom mentality and a sense of Chekhovian loss meet in uneasy suspension.
Ah, yeah. Limitless possibility always paired with inevitable disappointment. It's perfect.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, how do we apply this incredible, sometimes unsettling body of work to our own, you know, frantic, fragmented lives right now?
Well, I think Didion's method translates directly into developing critical media literacy.
Yeah.
She teaches us to be relentlessly skeptical of those neat, tidy stories we get from politics, the news, social media.
Right.
So you could apply this by looking at, say, a viral tweet or a big political headline and just asking yourself, what fragment of complex reality is this simple story maybe ignoring or distorting?
That's powerful and useful. She also offers insight into the psychology of crisis, doesn't she? Her work kind of suggests that these periods of acute confusion, disorientation, they might actually be necessary, even productive.
Yeah, because they force us to abandon inadequate structures, old ways of thinking, and maybe lead to a more authentic self-understanding. The personal stress we feel is often a direct response to these broader cultural contradictions.
And finally, she encourages you to embrace ambiguity. I feel like the book is a real antidote to the pressure we all feel for simplistic black and white thinking.
Absolutely. It's an invitation to get comfortable with contradiction, with complexity, to recognize that the best insights often lie right there in the tension between two conflicting truths.
For me, what surprised me most revisiting it was her profound, almost devastating insight that personal authenticity is really impossible without a sophisticated understanding of how historical context shapes us and often limits our individual consciousness. You just can't separate the self from the era you live in.
Yeah, that's deep. And what I loved most, I think, was just her distinct voice, that cool, detached willingness to observe what she called the stubborn untidiness of experience, rather than rushing in to provide false certainty or comforting lies. It's just a masterclass in honest observation. It forces us to look at the shadows.
So if you take one thing away today, maybe remember the profound fragility of meaning-making. It's something we have to actively construct and reconstruct all the time.
Which leads us to a final provocative thought for you to consider. Are the stories you tell yourself right now the ones you tell yourself in order to live? Are they still serving you? Or have they become inadequate to explain the world as it truly is?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akhotra Foundation.